Hello, and welcome to A More Beautiful Way, a project and podcast dedicated to slowing down and centering the sacred in our everyday lives. Why do we do this work? Because when we slow down, when we simplify, and when we remember what is most sacred to us, we are able to show up to ourselves, to our families, to our communities, to our work in the world with more resilience and wholeheartedness and presence to whatever matters most. My name is Bethany Wilkinson. I'm an author and a spiritual director. And for today's conversation, I am your host. Let's dig in. So I had the incredible opportunity to interview Caitlin Curtis, who is incredible. I just loved being able to wander around some complex and nuanced ideas with her. We talked about daily routines. We talked about grief and rituals. We spent some time playing with the word and the idea and the importance of decolonization, indigeneity, just really important themes. So let me tell you about Caitlin. Caitlin is an award-winning author, poet, storyteller, and public speaker. As an enrolled citizen of the Potawatomi Nation, Caitlin writes on the intersections of spirituality and identity and on how that shifts throughout our lives. She also speaks on these topics to diverse audiences who are interested in truth-telling and healing. As an interspiritual advocate, Caitlin participates in conversations on topics such as colonialism and faith communities, and she has spoken at many conferences on the importance of interfaith relationships. In her new book, Living Resistance, An Indigenous Vision for Seeking Wholeness Every Day, Caitlin explores the journey of resisting the status quo of hate by caring for ourselves, one another, and Mother Earth. Besides her books, Caitlin has written online for Sojourners, Religion News Service, Apartment Therapy, On Being, Self Magazine, Oprah Daily, and more. Her work has been featured on CBS and in USA Today. She also writes here on Substack at the Liminality Journal. Caitlin lives in Philadelphia with her family. So that is a little bit about the brilliance that is awaiting you on this podcast episode. But as always, I'm so glad you're here. I hope that you were able to find something that meets you with connection and grace as you listen. And I can't wait to see you here in future weeks when I start writing and sharing ideas again. Until then, be well and enjoy this conversation between me and Caitlin. Caitlin.
Hi.
Glad you're here.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here with you.
Well, we were just talking about this, but I'd love to start with my first question, which is, where do you begin?
I love this because as I've shared with you, I have this, there's this Wordsworth quote that I've put, I know I put it in my first book, Glory Happening. It may have ended up in my second too. I don't remember, but the quote is to begin, begin. And just this idea of to do it, just do it. So I love that question and the spaciousness of it. And it made me think of mornings and what they mean to me, to begin a day, to begin, you know, the hours of how are you going to show up in the day, however that is. And that's what I thought of first when you asked is, I struggle as many people do with, setting up the morning where we're not rushing into work or rushing into checking our phones or rushing into life at all, you know, and what does a slow morning mean? And what does it mean to begin a day with intention? And I think I'm in the middle of a season where I'm redefining that for the next season. I think probably every seasonal change every few months, which is beautiful. I get to ask that question again. And I think I'm in the middle of that as spring is showing up full on and we're heading into summer. You know, it's like that time to ask what it will mean to begin even a day to begin that throughout the summer. So I'm in the middle of like dreaming of that, which is really fun, you know.
I love that. I really love it. Perhaps because similarly, I'm in this physical place that is coming alive. My husband and I are in this process of, we've had all these potted plants outside that we've accumulated, and we're in this process of planting them all in the ground finally. Yeah. And it almost feels like a metaphor for my whole life. Like I've been over the last few years, like a potted plant, and now we're really settling in, and I have tons of feelings about that. But also sitting with this question of what will my daily routine be as I'm shifting out of this like hyper virtual world into this very like tethered to a place world as we're farming more, and building community here. So I just love how you answered that, because it sparks new thinking in me as I think about, oh yeah, my daily routine and my mornings, and even how the creatures I'm sharing this acre with have needs that dictate how my morning goes.
Right.
Which is different than previous seasons.
Yeah. I love that metaphor that you are like a potted plant, and now, and the idea of beginning is cyclical. It's not like we begin once and that's it. And that's what's so beautiful about this seasonal world that we live in, is that we're constantly being asked, what will this beginning be? Or what will this beginning be? And then we have ends to things. And so what does it mean to end something and to begin another thing? And that's just so beautiful. I love it.
That makes me think of a question I didn't think of beforehand, but I'm curious to know how do you move through endings as a person, as a creative, as a parent, as a, I don't know. I'm just curious, when you think of endings, what comes up for you?
When I think of endings, I think of grief and ritual. I think those are two words that come up right away. I've had, you know, endings in the last years where it may have been the end to a certain season in a relationship, or, you know, or the end to, like right now we're moving. So we're leaving one home and moving to another. So it's the end of that season in that place, that this, that particular rental house we lived in, you know, so you're saying goodbye to these things. And it always draws me into, how can I like commemorate this before I go, before I leave it? Or how can I make sure I honor what this season meant to me, or what this relationship meant to me, you know? So I always think of how grief works, and that there is sadness and tears and that natural process that can take a long time. But then also like the intentionality of ritual, even if it's just like lighting a few candles and saying a few words about something, someone, some season, that you're commemorating it, and you're naming with gratitude what you are taking from it, you know? And I think that that's always really special.
Oh, I love it. I'm just thinking about some things that I want to put some ritual around as I transition away from some forms of my existence and into new ones. So thank you.
Yeah. I think that both of our Substack communities, I think in both of these spaces, we're holding a lot of space for people to transition and change and ask what's next, which I think is really beautiful about your writing, is you're just slowing down to examine so many things in new ways, or in old ways, or in changing ways. And I think that that's really beautiful. And I appreciate that about you, is just holding space for however change does show up, and processing that with your audience, I think is really special. So thank you for doing that.
Oh, thanks for mirroring that. Okay. I want to shift into talking a little bit about your book, which I love. And I was revisiting it this morning in preparation for our conversation, and I was struck this time by a little story that you tell at the end about a breathwork experience you had. And I just started training to facilitate breathwork like 2 days ago. And so, I signed up to train in facilitation because I had a breathwork experience like 2 years ago that was pretty, transformative, I would say. And it was surprisingly like activating and clarifying, and it was like a whole thing. So I was like, I want to be able to learn more about this, maybe hold this space for people in the future. But what really struck me about your story, and kind of how I saw it in conversation with other stories in your book, was the ways in which, and you can of course correct or clarify any pieces of this, but from what I understood, you had this experience with the little girl version of you in a way, and this theme of like reconnecting to your inner child and then also holding space for your children and then thinking about children in general was just a really beautiful theme in your book about resistance. And so I'm curious to hear how, I don't know, children and little people and young people came to feature so prominently in your thinking about living resistance in the world.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I am someone who didn't grow up very embodied. So I was disembodied a lot of my childhood, a lot of my adolescent years. And so embodiment practices actually make me really uncomfortable because I'm not used to them. I'd rather just stay in my head, even though that's not a healthy place to stay, and that I need to drop into my body to heal myself, you know? And so this, even spiritual practices like breathwork sessions, I'm always, you know, I go into them not expecting anything. Cause I just like think I'm not going to work or something, like my body won't work. And I know some people go into these and they get horribly triggered or traumatized. I want to acknowledge that that happens too, but this particular, session, yeah, I had this just really, visceral connection to my child self, and not necessarily to like a real memory. I mean, it could have been, but not to my knowledge, a real memory, but a, like the body energy that I knew she carried, and the inner world that I knew she carried. And so acknowledging her, and it was actually this juxtaposition of me like reliving the sensation of childbirth, and then all of a sudden being snapped back to this version of her. And so it was a very strange moment that I'll never forget. And I've always loved kids, and I've always had, I don't know, sort of this child likeness inside of me, despite, you know, the ways that we're taught to neglect that part of ourselves. Like, it's always been in me. And so this draw to like the magic of the world and curiosity and learning is so, central to who I am. And of course, becoming a mom just instilled that deeper in me. And my kids just teach me so much. Like, and everyone's kids, it's not just mine, but children are underappreciated maybe in our society. And I know it's gotten better in a lot of ways than it used to be with like the, you know, seen not heard kind of like kids don't say a thing, you know? But I can't help but constantly look to the kids that are growing up in our world now, knowing that they are the future generation, and then whoever comes after them. So it's like, how could we not hold so much just kind of reverence for them while helping them be who they are in the world and helping them, you know, I want my kids to not have the trauma I had. I want them to be able to be embodied and to process things and to have healthy coping mechanisms. You know, a lot of the things I didn't have, I want them to have. So even in my second book, Native, well, and in my first, I don't know, not just my own motherhood, but just the children in our society, they just hold so much wisdom. And as we dream for whatever future we want as adults, they are an integral part of that. And so they have to be part of our resistance, a part of our asking what needs to change in the world, you know, and our kids get mistreated so much by society. And so we owe that to ourselves, to our own inner children, and to them to fight for those relationships.
What would you say have been some of the, I want to say supports that have held you as you have worked with your inner child or healing, integrating her wisdom, the wisdom of the children around you? I'm just curious about what that support system might look like for you.
Yeah. Therapy is absolutely central and huge to this. Being able to go to a good therapist who can talk through those things is so helpful. Because we should still be having active conversations with our child selves today. I think that the idea that like they used to exist, but don't any longer. I mean, we are just grown-up versions of them. Like they're still in us. They still are us. But I think of it as this like merging of these two beings who are still one. It's kind of weird. But I mean, having conversations with our child selves really does do something in us. It really does help heal something in us, even if we don't understand it, you know? So having the support of my partner and our kids in that, like they know my journey, and having a therapist and even just a small circle of friends that get it, you know, and writing. I mean, writing, especially poetry, I think has been, I don't know, just a huge part of that process and journey for me, and is a very safe place, you know, to ask those questions and to kind of converse with her, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm. As you said that, it, especially that last piece about poetry, it made me think instantly about this journal I had when I was 14 or 15, where I wrote poetry constantly, and I don't anymore. Like I don't at all, but you saying that and thinking about little Bethany, I'm like, oh man, like maybe she has some stuff she wants to say in a different way. Yeah.
Do you still have the journal anywhere?
I do. It's actually in this closet behind me. Yeah.
Get it out and read it.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Wow. That could be a good practice for this afternoon. Yeah. I want to ask you about decolonization. I am curious to hear some of your thoughts on this because it features prominently in your work, and it is important work, and it also sometimes but feels so ubiquitous that it's everywhere and means nothing all at the same time, you know? I hope that makes sense. So I'm curious to hear if and how your understanding of decolonization has shifted or evolved over the last few years.
Yeah, I love this question because no one has really asked me this. And I think about it all the time because it has shifted. And so much so, you know, when a term becomes like popular again, which decolonization is not a new term. It's been around for generations, but you know how things cycle, they cycle in and out. And so we're in a time when this is a very popular term. And I think, I mean, I wrote even more about it in Native. The idea of decolonizing, of like sort of facing the colonialism that we are up against and that affects us, affects our bodies, affects us every single day, that's such a powerful thing to do for anybody, but especially for Indigenous people and Black people and queer people. You know, there's people in society who it can be essential to our well-being to ask some of these questions and to get to this point of really examining these things. Because I didn't grow up being sort of allowed to do that, right? So as an adult, it's been really liberating. But you're right in that when a thing becomes a fad or popular, it can lose its, not its meaning. It just gets murky, right? And so much so that I was like, do I even talk about it in this book? Like, but how could I not, you know? So, and there are different forms of decolonization. I think, of course, there's decolonization on the much larger level. You know, on the political level, on the socioeconomic level, but then there's also just like the daily acts of decolonization that we practice as people in our everyday life. And I think that right now in my life, I'm asking the questions of how we can work toward decolonization. I never want to say that we are decolonized, because I don't even know if that's possible, to be fully decolonized in the society we live in, but to work toward that, to dream toward it. What does it mean for my like daily life just as one person? Because decolonization has to happen on the systemic level and on the collective level, but I think it has to also start within each of us. Like there has to be sort of the seed planted of why are we even caring? Why does it matter? And that means that we have to look at our own stories and our own experiences of colonization, however that shows up in our lives. No matter who we are, we've all been affected by colonialism. So to ask that of ourselves and our stories, I think is really important. And I think that that's where I've landed lately, is watching these incredible like acts of decolonization on the global level, on these huge levels, and then also trying to hold the like micro of every day within our little communities, our little families. How do we do that? And I think that's my constant struggle, is the micro and the macro. And I think we all fall somewhere in between, you know? And that's the hard thing. And that's the nuance of it all, and the complexity, which I think is beautiful, and is what makes us human. But I'm constantly like, you know, am I not doing this word justice even in my work? Am I not making it relatable, or is it too much, or is it not enough? You know, I'm constantly asking, but I can't let go of it either. I think it's too important. And in Living Resistance, I talk about decolonizing and indigenization, which is a really, you know, there are some scholars that talk about the difference between the two and why one might be more important than the other. And I just find that both are important. So, you know, listening to Indigenous people, having Indigenous people at the center of our decolonization, what might that look like? And again, I think it's just another opportunity to dream of a better world, and to start, you know, taking large steps or small steps toward that and asking what it might mean. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I really resonate with that tension. Well, there are multiple tensions. Number one, like, how do we hold, especially as writers, how do we hold language and honor the legacy of a word or a term, honor the complexity of the ways communities have adapted it, but then also desiring to kind of hone it in a way, in like a specific context. And it's like this constant dance. It's like this one word holds so much, and it means so many things, past, present, future. And as a writer, how do I hold it? But then also, yeah, the tension between the micro and the macro, like I'm feeling that as my husband and I steward our homestead here, like, are we doing enough? You know, are these 20 pepper plants enough? And 20 is a lot, we're realizing, but is it enough? You know, when we think about some of the bigger challenges facing our world, and even just our like literal neighbors. Yeah.
And I mean, I wrote a book on the word resistance, and I was like, what am I doing? Like, this is another one of those words. But that's why I was so drawn to it, because what does resistance mean? And I, you know, I was willing to jump into the fire of all of that and risk trying to expand it and make sure it's not losing its meaning. And all of what we just said about decolonization, it's the same for a word like resistance and what it means and how we live that in our daily life.
Yeah. But what I love too, though, is that in doing that, you create so many entry points. I'm thinking about the Venn diagram. And so listeners are going to have to go read the book so that you have all this context, but it's so accessible from all these different sides, and then you wove them together in different ways. And so I think, or in my experience of the book, I should say. And so I appreciated you kind of blowing it open and saying, hey, there are all these on-ramps, and here's how they're connected, the personal and the collective and the ancestral and all of these pieces.
I'm so glad. I'm glad to hear that. Cause that was my hope, is that, you know, creating like a cyclical framework that we can process, and coming at it from these different perspectives across the micro and the macro, that somewhere we can find our way, you know, that no matter who we are, we can find our way in. And I hope that people get that from the book. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. Yeah. Something else I've been thinking about a lot that I'm really eager to get your thoughts on is this idea of all of us being Indigenous to some place in some way, even across centuries. And I see in my community, people from a variety of racial backgrounds, in some ways trying to reclaim some part of who they were pre-colonization, even if they're having to do like really deep research to give some language to that. I think of my husband over the last couple of years has done a lot of research on his Scottish ancestry. Yeah. And things like that. And so, for people who are listening and who are on this journey of trying to like reclaim or piece back together parts of their cultures or their stories or their songs or their religious practices from yesteryear, what caution or what encouragement or both would you give to those of us who are on this journey of finding our way home?
Yes. I think there's caution and encouragement, as with anything, of course. You know, this is another thing that's super complex. When I think about this, because I've heard different people say this idea, is that I hope we can do it without sort of erasing the things that have happened throughout history, the colonization, the enslavement, the racism, the white supremacy, you know, that has happened, the ways that it has traveled across the world, the ways that we've seen these moments in history of oppression, of deep oppression, of genocide, of so many different things. How can we have this conversation in a way that holds all of that too, you know? So not to be like, we're all indigenous somewhere, so we're all indigenous, you know? that gets a little scary, you know, because that's a different thing. But talking about the indigeneity of people from all over the world, of, you know, of indigenous African societies, of the indigenous Sami people, of, you know, the Maori people, like indigenous, you know, you have Scottish and Irish and all of these beautiful cultures all over the world that have deep, courageous roots. And I think that remembering that is beautiful, and trying to understand that, because we have this longing in us. We have to find our way home, right? And I think that's why so many of the DNA tests and so many things have become so popular. And for a lot of people, they have no idea where they came from. So finding that is finding pieces of yourself. And I would never try to steal that need from someone else, you know, like we should never do that to one another. And so I think holding it really tenderly, holding each other's stories with a lot of care. But I think that people who are really intent on doing this work, I think can form really beautiful community, which I'm sure you've seen. And the complexity of it is also just holding those stories helps us to form better community. And I hope more nuanced conversations about oppression and injustice that has happened throughout the centuries, and how we sort of trace the lines of history, which is so powerful, right? Because all of this comes down to the stories we tell. And that's the terrifying thing about stories, is how history gets written. You know, like it can be written in a way that holds up the oppressed, or it can be written in a way that erases the value and the lives of oppressed peoples throughout history. And so that's the caution that we have to hold with it all, is how do we help each other find our way home to ourselves and our people, and whatever that is, while also honoring all of it, you know. Yeah. I hope that helps.
It's complex. Definitely helps.
Yeah,
it is complex, but it's just been me and my little journal trying to figure it out. And so
yeah, you're not the only one, I promise.
Yeah, so I'm like, I feel like I only have a part of this. And so go ahead.
No, just it. Yeah, it is. And doing it on our own, trying to think through it, and then doing it in bits of community is so special. And, you know, just trying to help it come to life and understand it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, so good. I'd love to hear how your writing practice or process supports you in your journey of coming home to yourself in different seasons.
You know, I think that there's always that fear that if you, like if the thing that you love becomes your way to make money and your way of living in the world, that it can lose its spark and its magic for you. And writing, thankfully, that's never happened to me. And I think ever since I was little, you know, from like age, 12 to maybe 20, I wanted to be a singer-songwriter, and I wrote songs. So that was my, you know, I was still always journaling, but I was writing music. I was playing guitar and I was writing songs, and that was my outlet. And then I started a blog when my oldest son was born, and then I became a writer a few years later. And it's just been interesting to follow that thread back to even when I was little and realize that words have always been the thing I needed. And my journals, I have journals back to when I was about 8, and I'm so glad that I kept them to look back and a lot of it's actually slightly depressing to think about the things she went through that she just couldn't process. But I always had words. I did have words on these pages in these journals. I had poems I wrote, and so that's really truly like something that has tethered me my whole life. And even though I'm a writer now, and you know, there's a lot expected of that, even the process of writing books, I find to be so much fun and such a creative process. So it hasn't become too painful yet. It's been like, even under a deadline, it's still such beautiful work, because it's not just my writing, but it's me getting to read other people's books and just diving into their wells of wisdom, which is such a gift to have a stack of like 30 books that I have to read and know that I have to just like, this is my work, is reading from these people and then asking how their wisdom, you know, ties into what I'm trying to share. And in doing that, hopefully getting other people to read their book and kind of creating community, you know. I just find all that to be really beautiful. So it's not even just the writing itself, but the whole sort of world that we create around writing. It's not just me sitting at a desk, but it seems like it is, like it's a very solitary thing, but being a writer is actually deeply like communal and human and just connects me with other people in really beautiful ways. So I love it. And even if it's just writing poetry just for me or journaling just for myself, it still is keeping me tethered every day. And launching books is scary. It's very scary to you know, give this thing to the world and hope for the best that people like it, you know, but I really love it. I love doing it so much.
I just have a couple more questions for you. One is, how do you conceive of the divine in this season of your life?
That's a great question. I think, I guess I'll take this from the angle of, how I pray, maybe. I find myself lately that when I pray, maybe not lately for a little while, but when I pray, even if it's just kind of the spontaneous, like just needing to say something to the sacred, to creator, that I end up saying, Miigwech Mamagosnan, Miigwech Sagamakwe, which means thank you, creator, thank you, Mother Earth. And I think that acknowledging both of those beings together and acknowledging the gratitude first, which is a lot of Indigenous culture, is like rooting things in gratitude and connection, both to creator and to Mother Earth. That's just been really special for me too, through decolonizing, right? To find my way back home to my own culture and those ways of understanding the universe, or, you know, the world around us, or the sacred. I know that for a lot of people, even the word God is so triggering, and it is a bit for me, and or maybe I just don't really know what it's supposed to mean for me right now. So there's so many other words that I think so many of us can use. And I love that people have different words they use, you know. And a few years ago, there was a debacle at a school I spoke at, and people got really mad. They thought that I had said Mother Mystery in a prayer, even though I didn't. But then I was like, oh, but that's beautiful. So then I adopted it, and I started using that term, because it's so beautiful. Mother Mystery is such a beautiful term. So I think about that sometimes too, in this like horrible thing that happened to me at one of my speaking events, ended up opening sort of an avenue for a lot of people to find the divine in a new way. And I love that. But yeah, I think creator and K'che Manado, Great Spirit, and Sagamakwe, Mother Earth, I think that's it's so relational, and feeling that just acknowledgement of gratitude for wherever I'm at now. And also like, I need a lot of help all the time. So thanks for being there. It's kind of, I think that's where I land most days, you know? So.
What would you say you are longing for most in the world right now?
Oh, can I answer this on an individual level and then on the collective level?
Because I think please do
both of those. I think on an individual level, this book launch season has been really busy and very technological. It's been very heavy on the internet and on social media, and that is beautiful, but also creates quite a dissonance in our everyday lives. Like the work that you're doing is how do I ground my body back in the land? And I think that's what I'm also trying to do. You know, we've moved to a home that has a big yard, and I'm already like so excited and itching to garden again. And I've gardened in containers for years, but to put a garden in the ground or to just get those containers and fill them and just take care of these beings and let them take care of me. That reciprocal relationship is so beautiful. So on that level, on the personal, I'm just aching and hoping for maybe a quiet summer where the craziness in the book tour has passed a little bit. And now I have to just remember what it means to be human, because launching a book is so consumeristic, and you know, we're a product and we have to be, and I don't know how to fix it at this point in my life. That's a deep question I'm asking, but is how to, you know, allow myself to be human in the process. So I think that this summer, this coming season will be a time of just quiet and slow, I'm hoping. And on the collective, I think that the meta of what I hope for everybody is healing. And that may be like just healing any small thing, healing a little wound, healing a big gaping wound, healing intergenerational wounds, healing relationship wounds, like whatever it is. And then our like collective trauma wounds, or that collective consciousness that we don't want to acknowledge. I think that my writing, everything I do is hoping that something in my words or in my work can help somebody heal something. I think that's always at the core of my hopes for other people. And I think that's a lot of why I write, is to find healing for myself, but also for other people. So I hope for healing in the world. And I know we can't be totally healed, and that there's pain and trauma and hurt, but I think that we can work toward it, you know, every day. So that is my hope.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of A More Beautiful Way. You can learn more about A More Beautiful Way at www.amorebeautifulway.co. You can also follow A More Beautiful Way at A More Beautiful Way on Instagram. Please check out the show notes to learn more about Caitlin, to grab a copy of her book, and to subscribe to Caitlin's Substack, which is called The Liminality Journal. There is so much goodness, reading, inspiration, thoughtfulness that's available in Caitlin's body of work. And so I hope that you will make time and space to check it out. Otherwise, be well, and I will catch you here in a couple of weeks. Bye.